There he is strapped to a gurney with 6 thick leather bands, from his feet to his forehead. While he is being strapped down, a doctor pokes around his arms looking for a suitable vein, while a medic of some variety checks his vital signs. 10 feet away, behind glass windows and black curtains, the witnesses wait in 2 separate rooms, one for the victim, one for the killer. An IV is inserted and secured with tape. A large clock on the wall allows the unlucky soul to count down his last minutes. At precisely 10 p.m., the prison attorney reads the death warrant, and the warden asks the condemned if he has any last words. He can say whatever he wants. It's recorded and available online. He'll say a few words, maybe proclaim his innocence again, maybe forgive everyone, maybe beg for forgiveness. When he's finished, the warden nods to a guy hidden in a nearby room, and the chemicals are released. The condemned begins to float away, and his breathing becomes labored. Some 12 minutes later, the doctor pronounces him dead. Link knows all this. Evidently, he has other plans. I'm just a guy in the wrong place at the wrong time. At 9:30, all electricity at Big Wheeler is cut off, a complete blackout. They would later trace the power failure to a utility pole that got chainsawed in 2. The backup generator for Unit 9, Death Row, failed to start because its fuel injectors had been vandalized. At 9:30, we don't know this. All we know is that the boom boom room is pitch black. Link jumps to his feet and says, "Get out of the way." He slides the desk to jam the door. There is a quick flash of light above us, and noise, grunting. A panel in the false ceiling opens up, and a voice says, "Link, here!" The flashlight sweeps down and through the room. A rope drops, and Link grabs it. "Slow now," the voice says, and Link inches upward, literally hanging on for his life. There are sounds up there, grunting and scuffling, but I can't tell how many men are involved. Within seconds, Link is gone, and if I were not so stunned, I would laugh. Then I realize that I'll probably get shot. I take off my coat and tie and stretch out on the army cot. Guards kick the door open and burst in with guns and a flood of light. "Where is he?" one guard barks at me. I point to the ceiling. They yell and curse as 2 of them yank me up and drag me into the hall, where dozens of guards and cops and officials are running around in complete panic. "He's gone! He's gone!" they are yelling. "Check the roof!" In the hall and in the midst of an incredible racket, I can hear the thumping of a helicopter. They drag me into a room, then another. In the chaos, I hear a guard yell that Link Scanlon has vanished. It takes an hour for the lights to come on. I am eventually arrested by the state police and taken to the nearest county jail. Their initial theory is that I am an accomplice. Chapter 7. The pieces soon come together, and because I am being partially blamed for the escape, I have access to the information. I'm not worried about the charges. They can't stick. At 9:30 that night, there were 2 news helicopters buzzing around the fringes of Big Wheeler. The prison officials and police had warned them to stay away, but they were close by. In a show of muscle, the state police flew in 2 of its own helicopters to secure the airspace over the prison, and this proved helpful when the trouble started. It also proved distracting. There was a tremendous amount of smoke hanging over the prison, as 6 different fires were blazing at one time. Witnesses said the noise was deafening. 4 helicopters in the area, dozens of emergency vehicles with sirens, radios squawking, guards and police yelling, guns being shot, fires roaring. On cue and with impeccable timing, Link's small black helicopter arrived from nowhere, descended through the clouds of smoke, and snatched him off the roof of Unit 9. There were witnesses. Several guards and prison employees saw the helicopter as it hovered for a few seconds, dropped a line, then disappeared back into the smoke, with 2 men swinging from the lifeline. A guard in a tower at the unit managed to fire a few shots, but hit nothing. One of the state's choppers gave chase, but was no match for whatever brand and model Link leased for the night. It was never found. No record of it was ever traced. It flew low to avoid radar. Air traffic control did not see it. A farmer 60 miles away from Big Wheeler told authorities he saw a small helicopter land on a county road a mile from his front porch. A car met it, then both disappeared. An investigation dragged on and 3 officials got fired. It was eventually revealed that, 1, the Boom Boom Room is part of an old section of Unit 9 and was built back in the 1940s. 2, its roof is 3 feet higher than the rest of Death Row. 3, between the ceiling and the roof there is a crawl space crammed with ductwork, heating vents, and electrical work. 4, the crawl space winds around and branches off, and one section of it leads to an old door that opens onto the flat roof. And 5, the 2 guards who had roof duty that night had been dispatched to help with the riot. So there was no one on the roof when Link made his dramatic escape. What if the guards had been there? Given the skill and expertise of the operative who fetched Link, it's safe to speculate that the guards would have been shot between the eyes. This Spider-Man, as he was nicknamed by the investigators, is already a legend. There are a lot of what-ifs, but few answers. Faced with certain death, Link Scanlan figured he had nothing to lose by attempting a ridiculous escape. He had the money to hire the right commandos and equipment. He got lucky, and it worked. There was a possible but unconfirmed sighting in Mexico. I haven't heard from my client, and don't really expect to. Chapter 8. In addition to Big Wheeler, there are 12 or so prisons in this state, each with a different security classification. I have clients in most of them, and they write me letters begging for money and demanding I do something to get them out. For the most part, I ignore this correspondence. I have learned that a letter from me only encourages an inmate to write again and demand more. For those of us who defend criminals, there is always the possible scenario in which an ex-client with a grudge shows up after years in the pen and wants to discuss mistakes made at trial. But I don't dwell on this. It's just part of the job and another reason I carry a gun. To keep me in my place, our esteemed prison officials ban me from visiting any prison for an entire month after the Scanlan escape. However, as it becomes clear that Link outfoxed them with no help from me, they eventually relent. There are a few clients that I visit occasionally. These little road trips get me out of town for a day. Partner and I are driving to a medium security facility affectionately called Old Roseburg, named after a governor from the 1930s who himself was later sent to prison. He died there, in a slammer bearing his own name. I've often wondered what that felt like. According to legend, his family tried in vain to get him paroled so he could die at home, but the sitting governor wouldn't allow it. He and Roseburg were blood enemies. The family then tried to change the name of the prison, but that would have ruined a colorful story, and the legislature declined. The prison officially remains the Nathan Roseburg Correctional Facility. We are cleared through the main gate and park in an empty visitor's lot. 2 guards with high-powered rifles watch us from the tower, as if we might haul in some weapons or a pound or two of cocaine. At the moment, there is no one else to watch, so we get their full attention. Chapter 9. After Partner was acquitted for killing a narc, he begged me for a job. I wasn't hiring at the time, and I haven't hired since, but I couldn't say no. He was headed back to the streets, and if I didn't help him, he would end up either dead or in prison. Unlike most of his friends, he had a high school diploma and had even managed to pick up a few credits at a community college. I paid for more classes, most at night. He blitzed through a paralegal curriculum and got himself certified. Partner lives with his mother in a subsidized apartment in the city. Most of the units in his building are packed with large families, but none of the traditional variety, mother, father, children. Almost all the fathers are gone, either locked up or living elsewhere and producing more children. The typical apartment belongs to a grandmother, a long-suffering soul who's stuck with a passel of kids who may or may not be blood-related. Half the mothers are in prison. The other half work 2 and 3 jobs. Young cousins drop in and out. Almost every family is in a chaotic state of flux. The primary goal is to keep the kids in school, away from the gangs, alive, and hopefully out of prison. Partner guesses that half of them will drop out anyway, and most of the boys will end up in jail. He says he's lucky because it's just him and his mother in the small apartment. There is a tiny spare bedroom that he uses as an office for his work, our work. Many of my files and records are stored there. I often wonder what my clients would do if they knew their confidential files were actually kept in Army surplus cabinets in a 10th-floor apartment in a government housing project. I don't really care, because I trust Partner with my life. He and I have spent hours in the little room, digging through police reports and plotting trial strategies. His mother, Miss Luella, is partially disabled by severe diabetes. She does some sewing for friends, keeps a spotless apartment, and cooks occasionally. Her primary job, as far as I'm concerned, is answering the telephone for the Honorable Sebastian Rudd, attorney at law. As I said, I'm not listed in any phone book, but my office number does get passed around. In fact, people call that number all the time, and they get Miss Luella, who sounds as crisp and efficient as any receptionist sitting at a fine desk in a tall building and directing calls for a firm with hundreds of lawyers. She'll say, "Sebastian Rudd, attorney at law, how may I direct your call?" As if the firm has dozens of divisions and specialties. No caller ever gets me the first time because I'm never at the office. "What office?" She'll say, "He's in a meeting," or "He's in a deposition," or "He's in a trial," or my favorite, "He's in federal court." Once she has effectively stiff-armed the caller, she zeroes in on his or her legal problem with, "And this is regarding what?" A divorce. The caller will get, "I'm sorry, but Mr. Rudd does not handle family matters." A bankruptcy, real estate closing, will, deed, contract, the same response. "Mr. Rudd doesn't do those." A criminal matter might get her attention, but she knows that most lead nowhere. So few of the accused can afford a fee. She'll lead the caller through her standard questions to determine whether or not they can pay. Someone's been injured? Now we're talking. She'll go into her sympathy mode and extract all manner of information. She won't let them off the phone until she's picked them clean and gained their trust. If the facts fall into place and the case shows real potential, she'll promise to have Mr. Rudd stop by the hospital that very afternoon. If the caller is a judge or some other important person, she treats them with great respect, ends the call, and immediately sends me a text message. I pay her $500 a month in cash and an occasional bonus when I settle a good car wreck. Partner, too, is paid in cash. Miss Luella's people were from Alabama, and she learned to cook the Southern way. At least twice a month, she'll fry chicken and boil collards and bake cornbread, and I'll eat until I can hardly breathe. She and Partner have managed to transform the small, cheap, mass-produced apartment into a home, a place of warmth. There is a sadness, though, a cloud that hangs like a thick fog and will not go away. Partner is only 38, but he has a 19-year-old son at Old Roseburg. Jameel is serving 10 years for gang-related crap, and he's the reason for our visit today. Chapter 10. After we do the paperwork and get patted down, Partner and I walk half a mile along sidewalks lined with chain link and razor wire to Camp D, a tough unit. We go through security again and deal with grim-faced guards who would like nothing better than to turn us away. Because Partner is a certified paralegal and carries the paperwork to prove it, he is allowed into the visiting wing with me. A guard selects a consultation room for attorneys, and we take our seats facing a screen. Attorneys can visit any time, with notice, while the families are limited to Sunday afternoons only. As we wait, Partner, who says little, now says even less. We check on Jameel at least once a month, and the visits take a toll on my confidant. He carries heavy burdens because he blames himself for many of his son's problems. The kid was headed for trouble, but after Partner's acquittal, the cops and prosecutors were out for revenge. Kill a cop, even in self-defense, and you make some nasty enemies. When Jamil was arrested, there was no room for negotiation. The max was 10 years, and the prosecutors wouldn't budge. I represented him, pro bono, of course, but there was nothing I could do. He was caught with a backpack full of pot.
Only 9 years to go, Partner says softly as we stare at the screen. Man, oh man. I lie awake at night and wonder what he'll be like in 9 years. 28 years old and back on the streets. No job, no education, no skills, no hope, no nothing. Just another convict looking for trouble.
Maybe not, I say cautiously, though I have little to add. Partner knows this world far better than me. He'll have a father waiting on him, and a grandmother. I'll be around, I hope. Between the three of us, we'll think of something.
Maybe you'll need another paralegal by then, he says, with a rare smile, though a brief one.
Never know. A door opens on the other side, and Jamil walks through it, followed by a guard. The guard slowly unsnaps the handcuffs and looks at us.
Morning, Hank, I say.
Hello, Rudd, he says.
Hank is one of the good guys, according to Jamil. I suppose it's some sort of commentary on my law practice that I'm on such good terms with some of the prison guards. Some, but certainly not all.
Take your time, he says, and disappears.
The length of the visit is determined by Hank and Hank alone, and since I'm nice to him, he doesn't care how long we stay. I've had hard asses say things like,
You got 1 hour, max, or make it quick.
But not Hank. Jamil smiles at us and says,
Thanks for coming.
Hello, son,
Partner says properly.
Great to see you, Jamil, I say.
He falls into a plastic chair. The kid is 6'5", skinny, and seemingly made out of rubber. Partner is 6'2" and built like a fireplug. He says the kid's mother is tall and lanky. She's been out of the picture for years, vanished into the black hole of street life. She has a brother who played basketball at a small college, and Partner has always assumed Jamil came from that gene pool. He was 6'3" in the 9th grade, and scouts were beginning to notice. At some point, though, he discovered pot and crack and forgot about the game.
Thanks for the money, he says to me.
I send him $100 a month, which he's supposed to use for canteen food and basics such as pencils, paper, stamps, and soft drinks. He bought a fan. Old Roseburg is not air-conditioned. None of our prisons are. Partner sends him money, too, though I have no idea how much. 2 months after he landed here, they raided his cell and found some pot hidden in his mattress. A snitch had squealed, and Jamil spent 2 weeks in solitary. Partner would have choked him if he could have penetrated the screen, but the kid swore it would never happen again. We talk about his classes. He's taking remedial courses in an effort to get his high school equivalent, but Partner is not impressed with his progress. After a few minutes, I excuse myself and leave the room. Father and son need time alone, which is why we're here. According to Partner, the conversations get rough and emotional. He wants his son to know that his father cares deeply and is watching from a distance. Old Roseburg is full of gangs, and Jamil is easy prey. He swears he's not involved, but Partner is skeptical. Above all, he wants the kid to be safe, and membership in a gang is often the best protection. It also leads to warfare and revenge and the circle of violence. 7 inmates were killed last year at Old Roseburg. It could be worse. Down the road is a U.S. penitentiary, a federal joint, and they average 2 murders a month. I buy a soft drink from a vending machine and find a spot in a row of empty plastic chairs. No other lawyer is visiting today, and the place is empty. I open my briefcase and spread papers on a table covered with old magazines. Hank appears and says hello again. We chat for a few minutes. I ask how the kid is doing. He says,
All right, nothing great. He's surviving and he hasn't been hurt. He's been here a year and knows his way around. Doesn't want to work, though.
I got him a job in the laundry, and he lasted a week. Goes to most of his classes, but not all of them.
A gang?
Don't know, but I'm watching.
Another guard enters through a door far away, and Hank suddenly has to go. He can't be seen fraternizing with a lowly criminal defense lawyer. I try and read a thick brief, but it's too boring. I walk to a window that looks out upon a vast yard lined with double rows of chain link. Hundreds of inmates, all in prison whites, are killing time as guards look down from a tower. Young and black, almost all of them. According to the numbers, they're in for nonviolent drug offenses. The average sentence is 7 years. Upon release, 60% will be back here within 3 years.
And why not?
What's on the outside to prevent their return? They are now convicted felons, a branding they will never be able to shake. The odds were stacked against them to begin with, and now that they're tagged as felons, life in the free world is somehow supposed to improve? These are the real casualties of our wars. The war on drugs, the war on crime. Unintended victims of tough laws passed by tough politicians over the past 40 years. 1 million young black men now warehoused in decaying prisons, idling away the days at taxpayer expense. Our prisons are packed. Our streets are filled with drugs. Who's winning the war? We've lost our minds.
Chapter 11. After 2 hours, Hank says it's time to wrap things up. I knock and re-enter the room, an unventilated little box that's always stuffy. Jamil sits with his arms crossed, his eyes on the floor. Partner sits with his arms crossed too, staring at the screen, and I get the feeling that, though much has been said, no words have passed in some time. I say, "We gotta go." This is what both want to hear. They manage to say goodbye with some fondness. Jamil thanks us for coming, passes along greetings and love to Miss Luella, and stands as Hank enters the room from behind him. Driving away, Partner says nothing for an hour.
Chapter 12. Link Scanlon is not my first mobster. That honor goes to a sensational crook named Dewey Nutt, a man I do not visit in prison. While Link relished the blood, broken bones, intimidation, and notoriety, Dewey went about his life of crime as quietly as possible. While Link dreamed of being a mafia don from childhood, Dewey was actually an honest furniture salesman who didn't break bad until he was in his mid-30s. While Link's net worth was substantial but largely untraceable, a business magazine claimed Dewey was worth $300 million before his troubles. They sent Link to death row. Dewey got 40 years in a federal slammer. Link managed to escape. Dewey has hair down to his waist and grows organic herbs and vegetables in a prison garden. Dewey Nutt was a fast-talking salesman who moved a ton of cheap furniture, and with his earnings he bought a rental house, then another, then several more. He learned the trick of using other people's money and acquired a prodigious appetite for risk. He parlayed his properties and loans into shopping centers and subdivisions. During a short recession, a bank said no to a loan, so he bought the bank and fired all the suits who worked there. He memorized banking regulations and found all of the gaping loopholes. During a longer recession, he picked up a few more banks and some regional mortgage companies. Money was cheap, and Dewey Nutt proved to be a master at the borrowing game. His downfall, as we later learned, began with his penchant for double and even triple collateralizing assets. A visionary in the world of shady profits, he was one of the first to churn the fertile fields of subprime mortgages. He fine-tuned the intricacies of loan sharking. He became a skilled briber of politicians and regulators. Add tax evasion, money laundering, mail fraud, insider trading, and the outright looting of pension funds, and Dewey richly deserved his 40 years. Those still searching for hidden remnants of his fortune include an entire cast of present and former enemies, some banking regulators, at least 2 bankruptcy courts,
his ex-wife's lawyers, and several branches of the federal government. So far, they've found nothing. When Dewey was 49, his shiftless son, Alan, was caught with a trunkload of cocaine. Alan was 20, a real mess of a kid, and was trying to impress his father with his own style of entrepreneurship. Dewey was so incensed and embarrassed that he refused to hire a lawyer for Alan. A friend referred him to me. I took one look at the seizure and realized the cops had blown it. They had no warrant and no probable cause to search the car. It was cut and dried, black and white. I filed the proper motions and briefs, and the city half-heartedly contested the issue. The cocaine bust was ruled unconstitutional, the evidence was thrown out, and all charges against Alan were dismissed. It was a big story for a few days, and I got my picture in the papers for the first time. Dewey used his favorite lawyers for his heavy work, but he was so impressed with my slick maneuvers, he decided to throw me a few scraps. Most of it was outside the scope of my expertise, but one case intrigued me, and I signed on. Dewey loved golf, but had a hard time working it into his frenetic schedule. In addition, he had little patience for the staid traditions of most golf and country clubs, few of which, if any, would consider such an outlaw as a member. He became obsessed with the idea of building his own course and lighting it so he could play at night, either alone or with a few pals. At the time, there were only 3 other lit courses in the entire country, and none within 1,000 miles of here. 18 holes, all private, under lights, the ultimate rich boy's toy. To avoid the city's zoning Nazis, he selected 200 acres a mile from the city limits. The county objected. The neighbors sued. I handled the legal work and eventually won approval. More headlines. However, the real notoriety was just around the corner. A housing bubble popped. Interest rates spiked. A perfect storm blew in, and Dewey couldn't borrow fast enough. His house of cards collapsed in spectacular fashion. With flawless timing, the FBI, IRS, SEC, and a trainload of other tough guys with badges arrived on the scene, all waving warrants. The indictment was an inch thick and loaded with brutal allegations against Dewey, the obvious target. It also alleged grand conspiracies involving his bankers, accountants, partners, lawyers, a stockbroker, and 2 city councilmen. It detailed, in very convincing narratives, dozens of violations under the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, RICO for short, the greatest gift Congress has ever bestowed upon federal prosecutors. I was investigated and became convinced I would be indicted too, though I had done nothing wrong. Thankfully, I had managed to remain on the fringes. For a while, it seemed to be a shoot now and ask questions later inquisition. But the feds backed off and lost interest in me. They had much bigger crooks to nail. Alan was indicted, basically for being Dewey's son. When the FBI threatened to indict Dewey's daughter, he caved and agreed to a 40-year deal. The bogus charges against his kids were dismissed, and most of his co-indictees pled to light sentences. All avoided serious jail time. In short, Dewey did the honorable thing and took a mighty fall. He was building his golf course, grandly named the Old Plantation, just as the feds moved in. All the money vanished in a matter of weeks, and construction stopped, after the 14th green. Today, it is the only 14-hole course with lights in the entire world, as far as anyone knows. In honor of Dewey, it's called Old RICO. Its membership consists solely of his cronies and conspirators. Alan's job these days is taking care of the course and keeping it playable, which he manages to do. He plays non-stop himself and dreams of becoming a pro. He collects enough in dues to hire a few groundskeepers, all undocumented workers, plus we suspect he knows where some of Dewey's old loot is buried. I pay $5,000 a year, and it's worth it just to avoid the crowds. The greens and tee boxes are usually in good shape. The fairways can get rough, but no one cares. If we wanted a manicured course, we would join a real club, though none of us at Old RICO could survive the vetting process. Every Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, we gather for dirty golf, a game that bears little resemblance to what you might see on CBS. Dewey's original plans were to build the course first, so he would have a place to play, and then build the clubhouse, so he would have a place to drink. Absent a proper clubhouse, we meet for pre-game drinks and wagering in a converted tractor barn where Dewey once enjoyed cockfighting, perhaps the only crime not covered by his indictment. Alan lives upstairs with two women, neither his wife, and he's the organizer of Dirty Golf. The two gals work the bar, absorb the crudities, and banter with the crowd. The rituals call for the first pint, in fruit jars, to be lifted in a toast to Dewey, who's smiling down from a bad portrait above the bar. Tonight there are 11 of us, a workable number since old Rico has only 12 golf carts. As we drain the first pints, Alan goes through the rather raucous chore of bracketing the tournament, establishing handicaps, and collecting money. Dirty Golf costs $200 each, winner take all. Not a bad pot, but I've never won it. Winning takes skill, of course, but also a higher handicap and the ability to cheat without getting caught. The rules are flexible. For example, a bad shot that goes outside the fairway boundaries is always in play if it can be found. There's really no such thing as out of bounds at Old Rico. If you find it, play it. A putt of 3 feet or less is always conceded, unless an opponent is having a bad night and wants to play hard-ass. Every player has the right to require another player to putt everything. A foursome can agree that each guy can take a mulligan, or a free shot in the aftermath of a bad one. And if all four are in the right mood, each can take one mully on the front seven and another on the back. Needless to say, the sponginess of the rules leads to disagreement and conflict. Since not one golfer in 10 knows the real rules anyway, each round of Dirty Golf is loaded with incessant carping, bitching, complaining, and even threats. Partner drives my golf cart, and I'm not the only one here with a bodyguard. Since I play alone, tonight I'm paired up with Toby Chalk, a former city councilman who served 4 months in the wake of Dewey's demise. He drives his own golf cart. Caddies are forbidden at Old Rico. After an hour of drinking and preliminaries, we head for the course. It's getting dark, the lights are on, and we do indeed feel privileged to be playing golf at night. It's a shotgun start. Toby and I are assigned the fifth tee, and when Alan yells, "Go!", we race away, carts bouncing, clubs rattling and jangling, grown men half-drunk and puffing on big cigars, whooping and yelling happily into the night. Partner grins and shakes his head. Crazy white men. Part 3. Warrior Cops. Chapter 1. Here's what happened. My clients, Mr. and Mrs. Douglas Renfro, Doug and Kitty to everyone, lived for 30 quiet and happy years on a shady street in a nice suburb. They were good neighbors, active in local charities and the church, always ready to lend a hand. They were in their early 70s, retired, with kids and grandkids, a couple of dogs, and a timeshare in Florida. They owed no money and paid off their credit cards in full each month. They were comfortable and reasonably healthy, though Doug was dealing with atrial fibrillation and Kitty was rebounding from breast cancer. He had spent 14 years in the Army, then sold medical devices for the rest of his career. She had adjusted claims for an insurance company. To stay busy, she volunteered at a hospital while he puttered in the flower beds and played tennis at a city park. At the insistence of their children and grandchildren, the Renfros had reluctantly bought his and her laptops and joined the digital world, though they spent little time online. The house next door to them had been bought and sold a dozen times over the years, and the current owners were oddballs who kept to themselves. They had a teenage son, Lance, a misfit who spent most of his time locked in his room playing video games and peddling drugs through the internet. To hide his habits, he routinely piggybacked on the Renfro's wireless router. They, of course, did not know this. They knew how to turn their laptops on and off, send and receive emails, do basic shopping, and check the weather, but beyond that they had no idea how the technology worked and had little interest in it. They did not bother with passwords or security of any kind. The state police initiated a sting operation to crack down on internet drug trafficking and tracked an IP address to the Renfro's home. Someone in there was buying and selling a lot of ecstasy, and the decision was made to launch a full-scale SWAT team assault. Warrants, one to search the house and one to arrest Doug Renfro, were obtained, and at 3 o'clock on a quiet, starlit night, a team of 8 city policemen rushed through the darkness and surrounded the Renfro home. 8 officers, all in full combat gear with Kevlar vests, camouflage uniforms, Panzer-style helmets, night vision goggles, tactical radios, semi-automatic pistols, assault rifles, knee pads, some even with face masks, and a few even with black face paint for maximum drama, ducked and squatted and moved fearlessly through the Renfro's flower beds, their itchy fingers eager for combat. 2 carried flashbang stun grenades, and 2 carried battering rams. Warrior cops. The vast majority, as we would later learn, were woefully untrained, but all were thrilled to be in battle. At least 6 later admitted to consuming highly caffeinated energy drinks to stay awake at that awful hour. Instead of simply ringing the doorbell and waking the Renfros and explaining that they, the police, wanted to talk and search the house, the cops launched the assault with a bang by kicking in the front and rear doors simultaneously. They would later lie and claim they had called out to the occupants, but Doug and Kitty were sound asleep, as you would expect. They heard nothing until the invasion began. What happened in the next 60 seconds took months to unravel and get straight. The first casualty was Spike, the yellow lab who slept on the kitchen floor. Spike was 12, old for a lab, and hard of hearing. But he certainly heard the door crash just a few feet away. His mistake was to jump up and start barking, at which time he was shot 3 times by a 9mm semi-automatic pistol. By then, Doug Renfro was scrambling out of bed and reaching for his own gun, one properly registered and kept in a drawer for protection. He also owned a Browning 12-gauge shotgun he used twice a year to hunt geese, but it was tucked away in a closet. In attempting to defend the home invasion, our bumbling chief of police would later claim that the SWAT assault was necessary because they knew Doug Renfro was heavily armed. Doug had made it to the hallway when he saw several dark figures swarming up the stairs. An army veteran, he hit the floor and began firing away. Fire was returned. The gun battle was brief and deadly. Doug was shot 2 times, in the forearm and shoulder. A cop named Kiesler was hit in the neck, presumably by Doug. Kitty, who had rushed in a panic out of the bedroom behind her husband, was shot 3 times in the face and 4 times in the chest and died at the scene. Their other dog, a schnauzer who slept with them, was also shot and killed. Doug Renfro and Kiesler were rushed to the hospital. Kitty was taken to the city morgue. Neighbors gawked in disbelief as their street was lit by flashing lights while ambulances rushed away with the casualties. The police stayed at the home for hours and collected all possible evidence, including the laptops. Within 2 hours, before sunrise, they knew the Renfro's computers had never been used to peddle drugs. They knew they had made a mistake, but coming clean is simply not in their playbook. The cover-up began immediately when the commander of the SWAT team gravely informed television reporters on the scene that the occupants of the home were suspected of trafficking in drugs and that the man of the house, a Mr. Doug Renfro, had attempted to kill several officers. After his recovery from surgery, 6 hours after getting shot, Doug was told of his wife's death. He was also informed that the invaders were actually police officers. He had no idea. He thought they were armed criminals invading his home. Chapter 2. My cell phone rings at 6:45. I'm staring at an impossible bank shot to sink the 9-ball in a corner pocket and run the table. I've been drinking strong coffee and missing too many shots for the past hour. I grab the phone, look at the ID, and say, "Good morning."
"Are you awake?"
partner asks.
"Guess." I haven't been asleep at 6:45 in years. Neither his partner.
Might want to flip on the news.
Okay, what's up?
Looks like our toy soldiers just botched another home invasion. Casualties.
Shit,
I say, and grab the remote. Later.
Wedged into one corner of my den is a small sofa and a chair. A widescreen HD television hangs from the ceiling against a wall. I fall into the chair just as the first image appears. The sun is barely up, but there's enough light to capture the mayhem. The Renfro's front yard is swarming with cops and rescue personnel. Lights flash in the background behind the breathless and stuttering reporter. Neighbors in bathrobes gawk from across the street. Bright yellow police crime scene tape is strung high and low in all directions. It's a crime scene, all right. But I'm already suspicious. Who are the real criminals? I call partner, tell him to get to the hospital, and start snooping. Sitting in the Renfro's driveway is a tank, with an 8-inch barrel, thick rubber tires instead of treads, a camouflage paint job, and an open turret where, at the moment, a warrior cop is sitting, his face hidden behind biker sunglasses, his expression one of extreme readiness. The city's police department owns only one tank, and they're proud of it. They use it whenever possible. I know this tank. I've dealt with it before. Several years ago, not long after the terror attacks on September 11, our police department managed to bilk Homeland Security out of a few million bucks so it could arm up and join the national craze of ETF, extreme terror fighting. Never mind that our city is far away from the major metropolitan areas, or that there has been absolutely no sign of any jihadists around here, or that our cops already had plenty of guns and ninja gear. Forget all that. We had to be ready. So in the arms race that followed, our cops somehow got a new tank. And once they learned how to drive it, then, hell, it was time to use it. The first victim was a rather rustic old boy named Sonny Worth, who lived at the edge of the city limits in a part of town that realtors tend to avoid. Sonny, his girlfriend, and a couple of her kids were asleep at 2 a.m. when the house seemed to explode. It wasn't much of a house, but that really didn't matter. The walls shook, there was a roar, and Sonny at first thought a tornado had hit. No, only the police. They would later claim that they had knocked on the door and tried the doorbell, but no one inside the house heard anything until the tank plowed through the front window and stopped in the den. A mixed spaniel mutt tried to escape through the gaping hole, but was gunned down by a brave warrior. Luckily, there were no other casualties, though Sonny spent two nights in the hospital with chest pain, after which he went to jail for a week before he could post bond. His crimes? Bookmaking, gambling. The cops and prosecutors claimed Sonny was part of a ring, thus a conspirator, thus a member of organized crime, and so on. On Sonny's behalf, I sued the city for excessive force and got $1 million. Not one dime of which, by the way, came out of the pockets of the cops who planned the raid. As always, it came from the taxpayers. The criminal charges against Sonny were later dismissed, so the raid was a complete waste of time, money, and energy. As I sip my coffee and watch the scene, I think to myself that the Renfros were lucky in that the tank was not used to bust up their house. For reasons we'll never know, the decision was made to keep it in the driveway, just in case. If the 8 soldiers were not enough, if the Renfros had somehow managed a counterattack, then the tank would have been sent in to destroy the den. The camera closes in on 2 cops standing beside the tank, each with an assault rifle. Both weigh over 300 pounds. One is wearing a uniform of green and gray camouflage, as if he were hunting deer in the woods. The other is wearing a uniform of brown and beige camouflage, as if he were hunting insurgents in the desert. These 2 clowns are standing in the driveway of a suburban home, about 15 minutes from downtown, in a well-developed city of 1 million people, and they're wearing camouflage. The sad and scary thing about this image is that these guys have no idea how stupid they look. Instead, they're proud, arrogant. They're on display, tough guys fighting bad guys.
One of their brethren has been hit, wounded, fallen in the line of duty, and they're pissed about it. They scowl at the neighbors across the street. One wrong word, and they might start shooting. Their fingers are on the triggers. The weather comes on, and I go to the shower. Partner picks me up at 8, and we head to the hospital. Doug Renfro is still in surgery. Officer Kiesler's wounds are not life-threatening. There are cops everywhere. In a crowded waiting room, Partner points to a huddle of stunned people, all sitting knee to knee and holding hands. Not for the first time, I ask myself the obvious question. Why didn't the cops simply ring the doorbell at a decent hour and have a chat with Mr. Renfro? Two cops in plain clothes, or maybe just one in a uniform? Why not? The answer is simple. These guys think they're part of an extreme elite force, and they need their thrills, so here we are in another frantic hospital with casualties. Thomas Renfro is about 40. According to Partner, he's an optometrist out in the suburbs. His two sisters do not live around here and are not yet at the hospital. I swallow hard and approach him. He wants to wave me off, but I say over and over it's important that we talk. He finally steps away and we find privacy in a corner. The poor guy is waiting on his sisters so they can go to the morgue and start arranging things for their dead mother. Meanwhile, their father is in surgery. I apologize for intruding, but get his attention when I explain that I've been through this before with these cops. He wipes his red eyes and says, "I think I've seen you before." "Probably on the news. I take some crazy cases." He hesitates, then, "What kind of case is this?" "Here's what will happen, Mr. Renfro. Your father is not coming home anytime soon. When the doctors are finished with him, the cops will take him to jail. He'll be charged with the attempted murder of a police officer. Carries a max of 20 years. His bond will be set at $1 million or so, something outrageous, and he won't be able to make it because the prosecutor will freeze his assets. House, bank accounts, whatever. He can't touch anything because this is how they rig prosecutions. As if this poor guy hasn't been hit with enough crap in the past 5 hours. He closes his eyes and shakes his head, but he's listening. I go on. The reason I'm bothering you with this is that it's important to file a civil lawsuit immediately. Tomorrow, if possible. Wrongful death of your mother, assault on your father, excessive force, police incompetence, violation of rights, etc. I'll throw everything at them. I've done it before. If we get the right judge, then I'll have access to their internal records right off the bat. They're covering up their mistakes as we speak, and they're very good at it. He breaks down, fights it, gets some control, and says, "This is too much." I hand him a card and say, "I understand. Call me as soon as you can. I fight these bastards all the time, and I know the game. You're going through hell now, but unfortunately, it will only get worse." He manages to say, "Thanks." Chapter 3. Later that afternoon, the police stop by and have a chat with Lance, the shiftless kid next door to the Renfros. Just three cops, in plain clothes, bravely approaching the house without assault weapons or bulletproof vests. They didn't even bring their tank. Things go smoothly. No one gets shot. Lance is 19, unemployed, home alone, a real loser, and his world is about to change dramatically. The police have a search warrant. After they grab his laptop and cell phone, Lance starts talking. He's in the den when his mother comes home, and he's admitting everything. He's been piggybacking on the Renfro's Wi-Fi system for about a year. He trades on the dark web, on a site called Millie's Market, where he can buy any quantity of any drug, illegal or prescription. He sticks to ecstasy because it's accessible and the kids, his customers, love it. He does his business in Bitcoin, current balance valued at $60,000. All the details pour out in a torrent, and after an hour he's led away in handcuffs. So at 5 p.m., or about 14 hours after the raid, the police finally know the truth. But their cover-up is already in play.
They leak some lies here and there, and early the next morning I'm reading the Chronicle online and see the front page news. There are photos of Douglas and Catherine Renfro, she now deceased, and Officer Keesler. He sounds like a hero. The Renfros sound like outlaws. Doug is a suspect in an internet drug trafficking ring. Shocking, a neighbor says. Had no idea. The nicest people. Kitty just got caught in the crossfire when her husband fired upon peace-loving officers of the law. She'll be buried next week. He'll be indicted shortly. Keesler is expected to survive. There's not one word about Lance. 2 hours later, I meet Nate Spurio at a bagel shop in a strip mall north of town. We can't be seen in public, or at least identified by anyone who might be a cop or know a cop, so we alternate our secret meetings between A, B, C, and D. A is an Arby's roast beef joint in the suburbs. B is one of two bagel shops. C is the dreadful Catfish Cave, 6 miles east of the city. D is for a donut shop. When we need to talk, we simply choose a letter from our little alphabet game and agree on a time. Spurio is a 30-year veteran of the police force, a genuine, honest cop who plays by the book and despises almost everyone else in the department. We have a history, which began with me as a 20-year-old college boy who got too drunk in a beer hall and found myself outside on the sidewalk getting roughed up by the cops, one of whom was Nate Spurio. He said I cursed him and shoved him, and after I woke up in jail, he stopped by to check on me. I apologized profusely. He accepted and made sure the charges were dropped. My broken jaw healed nicely, and the cop who punched me was later dismissed. The incident inspired me to go to law school. Over the years, Spurio has refused to play the political games necessary to advance and has gone nowhere. He's usually hanging around a desk, filing papers, counting the days. But there is a network of other officers who have been ostracized by the powers that be, and Spurio spends a lot of time tracking the gossip. He's not a snitch by any means. He's simply an honest cop who hates what his department has become. Partner stays in the van in the parking lot, on guard in case other cops happen by and want a bagel. We huddle in a corner and watch the door. He says, "Boy, oh boy, it's a big one. Let's have it." He starts with Lance's arrest, the confiscation of his computer, the clear proof that the boy is a small-time dealer, and his detailed admission about tagging along on the Renfro's router. Their computers are squeaky clean, but Doug will be indicted day after tomorrow. Keesler will be cleared of all wrongdoing. The typical cover-up. "Who was there?" I ask, and he hands me a folded sheet of paper. 8, all from our department. No state boys, no feds. If I have my way, they'll be named defendants in a lawsuit seeking damages of, oh, I don't know, how about $50 million? "Who led the party?" I ask. "Who do you think?" "Summerall?" "You got it. We could tell from watching the news. Once again, Lieutenant Chip Summerall leads his fearless troops into a quiet home where everybody's asleep, and he gets his man." "You gonna sue?" I reply, "I don't have the case yet, but I'm working on it." "Thought you were the best at chasing ambulances." "Only the ones I want. I'll catch this one." Spurio chews on an onion bagel, washes it down with coffee, says, "These guys are out of control, Rudd. You gotta stop them." "No way, Nate. I can't stop them. Maybe I can embarrass them from time to time, cost the city some money. But what they're doing here is happening everywhere. We live in a police state and everybody supports the cops." "So you're the last line of defense?"
"Yep."
"God help us."
"Indeed. Thanks for the scoop. I'll be in touch. Don't mention it."
Chapter 4. Doug Renfro is too physically damaged and emotionally overwhelmed to meet with me, and since a meeting would have to take place in his hospital room, it's a bad idea anyway. The cops have the only door secured as if he were on death row. Privacy would be impossible, so I meet with Thomas Renfro and his two sisters in a coffee shop down the street from the hospital. The three are sleepwalking through their nightmare, exhausted, stunned, angry, grief-stricken, and desperate for advice. They ignore their coffee and at first seem content to let me do the talking. Without the least bit of bluster, I explain who I am, what I do, where I come from, and how I protect my clients. I tell them that I'm not a typical lawyer. I don't maintain a pretty office filled with mahogany and leather. I don't belong to a big firm, prestigious or otherwise. I don't do good works through the Bar Association. I'm a lone gunman, a rogue who fights the system and hates injustice. I'm here right now because I know what's about to happen to their father and to them. Fiona, the older sister, says,
"But they murdered our mother."
Indeed they did, but no one will be charged with her murder. They'll investigate, send in the experts, and so on, and in the end, they'll all agree that she simply got caught in the crossfire. They'll indict your father and blame him for starting the gun battle. Susanna, the younger sister, says,
"But we've talked to our father, Mr. Rudd. They were sound asleep when something crashed inside the house. He thought they were being robbed. He grabbed his gun, ran into the hallway, then hit the floor when he saw figures in the dark. Someone fired a shot, then he began returning fire. He says he remembers Mom screaming and running into the hall to check on him."
I say, "He's very lucky to be alive. They shot